Enjoyed that great talk. I'd like to welcome our final presenter today. It's Dr. Tim Weiss. Tim is a professional engineer and director of the Renewable Energy and Efficiency Policy at the Pembina Institute. He has written numerous technical reports and development manuals on renewable energy and energy efficiency on issues at national, provincial, and municipal levels, as well as issues specific to remote Aboriginal communities here in Canada. Tim has a PhD from the University of Quebec at Rimouski, studying wind energy development in remote Canadian communities, and has a master's degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Alberta. Tim.
Thank you. Was said, I'm a mechanical engineer, so I'm feeling a little bit out of my element at this conference here today talking about health issues, but I think certainly one of the areas that there is a direct connection to health is around the way we use energy. And that's in fact illustrated by how the Pembina Institute was founded, and this is the institute where I work. Last year was our 25th year in existence, and the reason we were founded was actually a natural gas blowout just outside of Edmonton. Which remains one of Canada's worst industrial accidents. And a group of citizens got together afterwards and said, how can we prevent something like this from happening again? And basically, we were born out of a citizens' movement to sort of help keep an eye on oil and gas development in Alberta. But the scale of that blowout, you can see, if you look really carefully, there it is. That's the drill rig that's blown out of the well there. And this is sour gas, which is H2S, which is fairly nauseous, toxic stuff. This was about 25 years ago, but when that well first blew out, you could smell it as far east as Winnipeg. So there are obviously real acute health consequences to the way we use energy and the way we develop energy at a local scale, but then also obviously on a climate change broader global scale. So again, about ourselves, I'm based in Edmonton, Alberta. We do have offices in Eastern Canada as well as in the United States, and we focus on technical issues as well as public policy, and that's where my area focuses largely on public policy and advocacy for clean energy. If you're interested in the stuff we do, it's all public and it's all available on the web. And so a little bit about myself. My background is engineering, but as I started doing my PhD, I wanted to do more technical issues on remote wind energy in the Arctic, and I came to realize that, and this is, I think, true for renewable energy in general, that it's really not technical barriers that are slowing us down, but really is policy barriers that are preventing us from moving forward. And so that's why I spend all my time now as a policy advocate as opposed to being a technical engineer. What's probably a little bit different about Pembina Institute as an NGO is that we actually do work in communities, and as an environmental NGO, I guess. These are some projects we've been on the ground, and so when I'm speaking today, having been to a lot of these communities and having dealt with renewable energy development, we understand how some of these things can work and also what can go wrong, and that's a collapsed wind tower there when things aren't monitored and things aren't taken care of. And so this is a list of the different communities we've worked with, starting in Alberta and then sort of spreading across the country. And you can see from that list a heavy emphasis on some of the groundwork we've done has been with First Nations and northern communities. And so this is a slide I probably don't need to put up in Quebec as much as maybe I do when I'm speaking in Alberta, but there's the issue of climate change is still talked about as if the science is unsettled, and anyone who understands science knows that science isn't ever settled. But I think the issue is that we've underestimated a lot of the effects that are happening, and when we talk about science being unsettled, that's a sword that cuts both ways, and in fact, things are actually moving faster than a lot of the scientific data has predicted. The good news is that we do have technologies available to us today that we can be adapting really rapidly and changing the way we consume energy, the way we generate energy. You can see the rapid growth in wind energy as well as solar energy globally, and that's really been driven largely in Europe, but it's happening in China is really in other parts of the world are picking up rapidly in terms of developing clean energy industries. In fact, 2008 was the first year that there was more money invested in renewable energy than was invested in nuclear, coal, and natural gas, electricity combined. That happened again in 2009 and again in 2010. And so we are talking about renewable energy at a very, very large scale now. And there are some very good success stories here in Canada. Ontario is phasing out its entire coal fleet in the next 4 years, with a large emphasis on renewable energy to do that. Nova Scotia has legislated a 40% renewable energy target by the year 2020, with an interim goal of 25% renewables in the next 5 years. So fairly aggressive steps by Nova Scotia, which would also reduce their coal fleet by about half. So there's some good things that are going on in Canada, but the reality is we're not acting fast enough, even to meet the government's own modest targets. You can see this is where the government has... I'm having trouble with this. This is the government's own climate change targets. And this is Environment Canada data, which shows that the current actions are only going to get us about a 20% of the way to meeting the government's own targets. And so while there is some progress in Canada and there are some technologies that we can be using, we're definitely not doing it fast enough. And so who's on the front lines of climate change? And I think this was well illustrated before me, but the First Nation, many First Nation and Aboriginal communities, particularly in the north, are disproportionately feeling the effects of climate change. So I'm going to focus specifically on remote communities because it's an area of interest for me. We have about 300 off-grid communities right now, and they're largely powered by diesel generators. And so this is, I think, an opportunity that we can adapt to climate change as well as mitigate some of the effects, the way to make these communities more resilient, but also reducing their own carbon footprints. I often feel awkward speaking about First Nation communities as a white person, and so there's not a whole lot I can do about that, but besides share some of the stories or share some of the quotes, I guess, that I've heard in visiting these communities. And some of the things that I've heard directly is the communities are concerned about rising energy costs, about difficulties in elders to being able to pay for their energy, and then also looking for ways that the communities should be generating their own power and ways they can be making their own communities more sustainable in the long term. And this is a photograph, I think, which is, acutely illustrates some of the dangers, particularly in northern Manitoba, northern Ontario, where and even in northern Quebec, where a lot of the fuel is transported up ice roads. And those ice roads are starting to become less and less stable every year. So another important thing, obviously, is that every remote community and every Indigenous community has its own unique challenges, and you can't paint them all with the same paintbrush. And so there's a varying range of what motivates the different communities to be involved in these types of things, clean energy, that is. Oil spills and diesel spills has actually been one of the largest concerns, particularly in British Columbia and the communities we've worked with out there that have had large diesel spills that have contaminated the salmon spawning areas or some of the community buildings. Local air pollution, in the bottom right-hand corner is a community called Cayucat. And I was there putting up a wind tower, and we installed some wind monitoring equipment. And once we did, we realized that the diesel plant was actually built upstream of the entire community. And it was blowing diesel exhaust right through the middle of the community. And we didn't know that until we actually were monitoring the wind for a wind turbine. Fuel shortages, cost of energy, local employment, and long-term price stability are all other issues that are driving communities to be looking for clean energy. So there's all sorts of drivers for remote communities looking for clean energy, but I think the question is often asked as well, do we need renewable energy policies, and shouldn't these technologies just be appearing on their own? And the reality is that obviously we do need policies I wouldn't be here. The market currently isn't addressing some of these issues. And some of the issues aren't addressed by current market is that we aren't internalizing the real health costs of the way we currently generate energy. This isn't specific to remote communities, but Ontario is estimating that by reducing their coal, by phasing out their entire coal fleet, they'll save $3 billion a year in health costs. We're obviously not internalizing the cost of climate change. We also currently directly incent the competitors to renewable energy, whether it's diesel in the remote communities or whether it's carbon capture and storage or nuclear. And then we also publicly incent the liabilities, I guess, of the traditional energy sources. And then another big challenge that we're facing are the remote communities as well as in system at whole, or I guess here in southern Canada, is the transmission and the current infrastructure is set up to deal with the existing infrastructure, and so we're trying to change that infrastructure with a different technology. And so I would argue that we obviously need some policies. We need to be changing the way things are done. And so the question then is, well, what will work for remote communities, and what do we need to be doing in the remote context that's different to be developing clean energies? And so we did a report for Agriculture Canada looking at what policies have been done around the world, whether it's in the United States, Australia, Northern Europe, that have helped remote and rural communities develop clean energy, but also develop it in a way that benefits those where the energy is being developed. And so some of the barriers that we looked at around renewable energy that are, I think, common, whether it's in remote communities or here in the southern part of the country, infrastructure is a barrier, policy instability, not knowing what policy is going to be there when. Obviously, the costs of renewable energy are still relatively high in many cases. Financing those projects, because they tend to be capital intensive, getting your project onto the grid or getting it connected, and just understanding awareness and information and how rapidly things are changing. So I think those are barriers that are universal to clean energy development, whether it's anywhere in the world or in many parts of the world. But there's some issues that are acute, I think, in remote and rural settings, and that's having the financial capacity to build these projects, having the ability also to own those projects and be developers and to truly benefiting from those projects financially. Having the human capacity as well as having the technical capacity, whether it's just having a crane in town to put up some of this equipment. The logistics, obviously, working in the Arctic are very difficult in remote communities. Sometimes a lot of the equipment, you get one barge per year, and if you forget one piece of equipment, you've got a year-long delay before you can build that project the next year. And then the economies of scale are obviously challenging as well. When you've got small communities, it can be difficult to make a project that would work in the south work in the north. And so when we did the study for Agriculture Canada, what we found was that we wanted to assess policies that were successful, and not only successful in terms of the environmental sense of reducing pollution, but also lowered energy costs, created sustainable development, created that economic benefit, and then the social benefit as well that created local jobs and local adaptive capacity. And so we found there are a lot of successes out there that we can be looking at. Australia has the Bushlight program, which has been successful in largely developing solar projects in remote Australian communities. Alaska, interestingly, just before Sarah Palin left office, actually set up a fairly large renewable energy fund in Alaska, which is funding a lot more renewable energy than we in the remote communities than we have here in Canada. Germany doesn't have the remote communities, or Denmark, but in the case of Germany, which is one of the largest developers of wind energy globally, and Denmark was one of the first places to really seriously develop renewable or wind energy. In both cases, almost a majority of those wind turbines are owned by rural and farmers and co-ops in the communities in which they're situated. And so I think that's another interesting example that we can be looking at in terms of if you're going to be developing clean energy projects, those benefits also stay in those communities. And so we found when looking at what other countries are doing, the key policy tools, if you're going to make renewable energy successful, is to make sure that the support, the policies you're going to put in place are long-term and they're stable and they're predictable. Because these projects take a long time to develop and you need to know they're going to be there from one year to the next. That incentives are linked to production and you're not just necessarily incenting something to be built, but you're incenting it to run over the long term. Often we give grants to build a project and then the project is built, it breaks down a couple of years from now, and then that can be the end of it. I think that's probably the same as whether you're building wells or other types of things in remote communities as well. The projects need to be simple and or the policies need to be simple and transparent, and their support at the early stage of development as well, so that it's not just a policy that supports the technology itself, but there's upfront planning around what the community goals are and community long-term strategy development. And I'm really encouraging local ownership because that makes sure that people are interested locally and you get that local champion that can drive those projects. And if you're interested in, or if a government is interested in these types of projects, if you're interested in incenting policies in remote communities, you need, or if you're interested in developing projects in remote communities, you need policies for remote communities, that you're not going to have a one-size-fits-all policy. In Ontario, for example, they have probably one of the most aggressive renewable energy policies in North America, but it doesn't include remote communities at all, and there hasn't been a single project in remote communities as a result. And I think another thing that we, in this particular case, is avoiding pilot projects. And pilot projects in these communities almost are destined to fail, because they're, you put one project up, and it's incredibly expensive to service that project. And the problem is that's been the way Canada's gone about developing it, is doing one project at a time. And whenever there's a problem, it's very expensive to go and fix that project. And then so that project dies, and everyone thinks that the technology doesn't work. Whereas in Alaska, what they've gone is they've gone big, and they've developed a whole bunch of projects at the same time. And so when there's problems in those communities, it costs the cost is spread out amongst all of those projects. I had to fly someone up there to service them. And so it's almost a go big or go home type approach that seems to work. And so I'm going to conclude with this last slide, which I like to talk about a lot. It's on the left-hand side, you can see two research stations. On the left-hand side is the McMurdo Research Station, which is an American research station. It's about 5 or 6 times the size of a New Zealand research station. And so in electrical terms, they're asymmetric loads. One is much bigger than the other. They run at different frequencies. The American system runs at a 60 hertz frequency, and the New Zealand runs at 50 hertz frequency. They're connecting these two systems together through 3 wind turbines. And so from a technical engineering challenge, this is a really difficult problem. It's also, they're going to get 60% of their power from those wind turbines, not 16, but 60% directly from the wind. So you've got asymmetric loads, you've got different frequencies, you've got an incredibly high penetration of a variable resource, and they're doing this in Antarctica. And this is the second one they've built. And so the point of this story is, this is the most challenging engineering problem you can think of from a renewable energy point of view. You're not going to get a more complex problem than this, and we're already doing it. It can be done. The issue is the policies are what's holding us back. And so if we can be doing this in Antarctica, we can be doing it here in Quebec, we can be doing it anywhere else in the country. So with that, thank you for your time.